5. The Domestication of Hunch. My landlady, a voluble man, arranged my journey into the east. If a person wants to visit fastnesses, he's got to cross the Kargaf, over the mountains into old Karhait, to Rea, the old king's city. Now I'll tell you, a half-fellow of mine runs a landboat caravan over the Eskar Pass, and yesterday he was telling me over a cup of orsh that they are going to make their first trip this summer on Gethany Osmi, it having been such a warm spring and the road already clear up to Engohar, and the ploughs will have the pass clear in another couple of days. Now you won't catch me crossing the Kargav, a henrang for me and a roof over my head. But I'm a Yomeshta, praise to the 900 throne upholders, and blessed be the milk of Mesh. And one can be a Yomeshta anywhere. We're a lot of newcomers, see? For my lord Meshe was born 2,202 years ago, but the old way of the Handara goes back 10,000 years before that. You have to go back to the old land if you're after the old way. Now look here, Mr. AI. I'll have a room in this island for you whenever you come back, but I believe you're a wise man to be going out of Erhenrang for a while, for everybody knows that the traitor made a great show of befriending you at the palace. Now, with old Tiber as the king's ear, things will go smooth again. Now, if you go down to the new port, you'll find my hearth fellow there. And if you tell him I sent you... And so on. He was, as I said, voluble, and having discovered that I had no ship Grethor, took every chance to give me advice, though even he disguised it with ifs and as-ifs. He was the superintendent of my island. I thought of him as my landlady, for he had fat buttocks that wagged as he walked, and a soft, fat face, and a prying, spying, ignoble, kindly nature. He was good to me, and also showed my room while I was out to thrill-seekers for a small fee. See the mysterious envoy's room. He was so feminine in looks and manner that I once asked him how many children he had. He looked glum. He had never borne any. He had, however, sired 4. It was one of the little jolts I was always getting. Cultural shock was nothing much compared to the biological shock I suffered as a human male among human beings who were, 5/6 of the time, hermaphroditic neuters. The radio bulletins were full of the doings of the new Prime Minister, Pema Har Grem Irtib. Much of the news concerned affairs up north in the Sinof Valley. Tibe, evidently, was going to press Karhide's claim to that region. Precisely the kind of action which, on any other world at this stage of civilization, would lead to war. But on Gethen, nothing led to war. Quarrels, murders, feuds, forays, vendettas, assassinations, tortures and abominations, all these were in their repertory of human accomplishments, but they did not go to war. They lacked, it seemed, the capacity to mobilize. They behaved like animals in that respect, or like women. They did not behave like men or ants. At any rate, they never yet had done so. What I knew of Orgeraine indicated that it had become, over the last 5 or 6 centuries, an increasingly mobilizable society, a real nation-state. The prestige competition, heretofore mostly economic, might force Karhide to emulate its larger neighbor, to become a nation instead of a family quarrel, as Estraven had said, to become, as Estraven had also said, patriotic. If this occurred, the Gethenians might have an excellent chance of achieving the condition of war. I wanted to go to Orgeraine and see if my guesses concerning it were sound, but I wanted to finish up with Karhide first. So I sold another ruby to the scar-faced jeweller in Eng Street, and with no luggage but my money, my Anne Siebel, and a few instruments, and change of clothes, set off as a passenger on a trade caravan on the first day of the first month of summer. The landboats left at daybreak from the wind-swept loading yards of the new port. They drove under the arch and turned east. 20 bulky, quiet-running, barge-like trucks on caterpillar treads, going single file down the deep streets of Erhenrang through the shadows of morning. They carried boxes of lenses, reels of sound tapes, spools of copper and platinum wire, bolts of plant-fiber cloth raised and woven in the west fall, chests of dried fish flakes from the gulf, crates of ball bearings and other small machine parts, and 10 truckloads of Orgota Kardik grain, all bound for the Pering storm border, the northeast corner of the land. All shipping on the great continent is by these electric-powered trucks, which go on barges on the rivers and canals where possible. During the deep snow months, slow tractor ploughs, power sledges, and the erratic ice ships on frozen rivers are the only transport besides skis and man-hauled sledges. During the thaw, no form of transport is reliable, so most freight traffic goes with a rush come summer. The roads then are thick with caravans. Traffic is controlled, each vehicle or caravan being required to keep in constant radio touch with checkpoints along the way. It all moves along, however, crowded, quite steadily, at the rate of 25 miles per hour, Terran. The Athenians could make their vehicles go faster, but they do not. If asked why not, they answer, why? Like asking Terrans why all our vehicles must go so fast, we answer, why not? No disputing tastes. Terrans tend to feel that they've got to get ahead, make progress. The people of Winter, who always live in the year one, feel that progress is less important than presence. My tastes were Terran. And leaving Erhenrang, I was impatient with the methodical pace of the caravan. I wanted to get out and run. I was glad to get clear of those long stone streets overhung with black, steep roofs and innumerable towers, that sunless city where all my chances had turned to fear and betrayal. Climbing the Kargav foothills, the caravan halted briefly, but often for meals at roadside inns. Along in the afternoon, we got our first full view of range from a foothill summit. We saw Kostor, which is 4 miles high from foot to crest. The huge slant of its western slope hid the peaks north of it, some of which go up to 30,000 feet. South from Kostor, one peak after another stood out white against the colourless sky. I counted 13, the last an undefined glimmer in the mists of distance in the south. The driver named the 13 for me, and told me stories of avalanches and landboats blown off the road by mountain winds and snowplow crews marooned for weeks in inaccessible heights and so on in a friendly effort to terrify me. He described having seen the truck ahead of his skid and go over a 1,000-foot precipice. What was remarkable, he said, was the slowness with which it fell. It seemed to take all afternoon floating down into the abyss, and he had been very glad to see it at last vanish with no sound at all into a 40-foot snowdrift at the bottom. At third hour, we stopped for dinner at a large inn, a grand place with vast roaring fireplaces and vast beam-roofed rooms full of tables loaded with good food, but we did not stay the night. Ours was a sleeper caravan, hurrying, in its Carhidish fashion, to be the first of the season into the Pering Storm country, to skim the cream of the market for its merchant entrepreneurs. The truck batteries were recharged, a new shift of drivers took over, and we went on. One truck of the caravan served as a sleeper, for drivers only. No beds for passengers. I spent the night in the cold cab on the hard seat, with one break along near midnight for supper at a little inn high in the hills. Karhide is no country for comfort. At dawn, I was awake and saw that we had left everything behind except rock and ice and light and the narrow road always going up and up under our treads. I thought, shivering, that there are things that outweigh comfort, unless one is an old woman or a cat. No more inns now among these appalling slopes of snow and granite. At meal times, the land boats came silently to a halt one after the other, on some 30-degree snow-encroached grade, and everybody climbed down from the cabs and gathered about the sleeper from which bowls of hot soup were served, slabs of dried bread apple, and sour beer in mugs. We stood about stamping in the snow, gobbling up food and drink, backs to the bitter wind that was filled with a glittering dust of dry snow, then back into the landboats, and on and up. At noon, in the passes of Wehoth, at about 14,000 feet, it was 82 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun and 13 degrees in the shade. The electric engines were so quiet that one could hear avalanches grumble down immense blue slopes on the far side of chasms 20 miles across. Late that afternoon, we passed the summit at Eskar, 15,200 feet. Looking up the slope of the southern face of Kostor, on which we had been infinitesimally crawling all day, I saw a queer rock formation a quarter of a mile or so above the road, a castle-like outcropping. "See the fastness up there," said the driver. "That's a building?" "That's Arik Kostor fastness." "But no one could live up there." "Oh, the old men can. I used to drive in a caravan that brought up their food from Erhenrang late in the summer, but of course they can't get in or out for 10 or 11 months of the year, but they don't care. There's 7 or 8 indwellers up there." I stared at the buttresses of rough rock, solitary in the huge solitude of the heights, and I did not believe the driver. But I suspended my disbelief. If any people could survive in such a frozen eyrie, they would be cut hiders. The road descending swung far north and far south, edging along precipices, for the east slope of the Kargav is harsher than the west, falling to the plains in great stair steps, the raw fault blocks of the mountains making. At sunset, we saw a tiny string of dots creeping through the huge white shadow 7,000 feet below, a landboat caravan that had left Erhengrang a day ahead of us. Late the next day, we had got down there and were creeping along that same snow slope, very softly, not sneezing, lest we bring down the avalanche. From there, we saw for a while, away below and beyond us eastward, vague, vast lands blurred with clouds and shadows of clouds and streaked with silver of rivers, the plains of Rur. At dusk of the fourth day out of Erhengrang, we came to Rur. Between the two cities lie 1,100 miles, and a wall several miles high, and 2,000 or 3,000 years. The caravan halted outside the western gate, where it would be shifted onto canal barges. No landboat or car can enter Rur. It was built before car hiders used powered vehicles, and they have been using them for over 20 centuries. There are no streets in Rur. There are covered walks, tunnel-like, which in summer one may walk through or on top of as one pleases. The houses and islands and hearths sit every which way, chaotic, in a profuse, prodigious confusion that suddenly culminates, as anarchy will do in Karhide, in splendor. The great towers of the Un Palace, blood-red, windowless. Built 17 centuries ago, those towers housed the kings of Karhide for 1,000 years, until Argaven Harg, first of his dynasty, crossed the Kargav and settled the great valley of the West Fall. All the buildings of Rur are fantastically massive, deep-founded, weatherproof, and waterproof. In winter, the winds of the plains may keep the city clear of snow, but when it blizzards and piles up, they do not clear the streets, having no streets to clear. They use the stone tunnels, or borrow temporary ones in the snow. Nothing of the houses but the roof sticks out above the snow, and the winter doors may be set under the eaves, or in the roof itself, like dormers. The thaw is a bad time on that plain of many rivers. The tunnels, then, are storm sewers, and the spaces between buildings become canals or lakes, on which the people of Rur boat to their businesses, fending off small ice floes with the oars, and always, over the dust of summer, the snowy roof jumble of winter, or the floods of spring, the red towers loom, the empty heart of the city, indestructible. I lodged in a dreary, overpriced inn crouching in the lee of the towers. I got up at dawn after many bad dreams and paid the extortion of a bed and breakfast, and inaccurate directions as to the way I should take, and set forth afoot to find Otherhod, an ancient fastness not far from Rur. I was lost within 50 yards of the inn. By keeping the towers behind me, and the huge white loom of the Kargav on my right, I got out of the city, headed south, and a farmer's child, met on the road, told me where to turn off for Otherhod. I came there at noon. That is, I came somewhere at noon, but I wasn't sure where. It was mainly a forest or a thick wood, but the woods were even more carefully tended than is usual in that country of careful foresters, and the path led along the hillside, right in among the trees. After a while I became aware that there was a wooden hut just off the path to my right, and then I noticed a quite large wooden building a little farther off to my left, and from somewhere there came a delicious smell of fresh, frying fish. I went slowly along the path, a little uneasy. I didn't know how the Handarata felt about tourists. I knew very little about them, in fact. The Handara is a religion without institution, without priests, without hierarchy, without vows, without creed. I'm still unable to say whether it has a god or not. It is elusive. It is always somewhere else. Its only fixed manifestation is in the fastnesses, retreats to which people may retire and spend a night or a lifetime. I wouldn't have been pursuing this curiously intangible cult into its secret places at all if I hadn't wanted to answer the questions left unanswered by the investigators. What are the foretellers, and what do they actually do? I had been longer in Karhide now than the investigators had, and I doubted that there was anything to the stories of foretellers and their prophecies. Legends of prediction are common throughout the whole household of man. God speaks, spirits speak, computers speak. Oracular ambiguity or statistical probability provides loopholes and discrepancies are expunged by faith. However, the legends were worth investigating. I hadn't yet convinced any Karhaida of the existence of telepathic communication. They wouldn't believe it till they saw it. My position exactly regarding the foretellers of the Handara. As I went along the path, I realized that a whole village or town was scattered about in the shadow of that slanting forest, all as random as Rur was, but secretive, peaceful, rural. Over every roof and path hung the boughs of the hemins, the commonest tree of winter, a stout conifer with thick, pale scarlet needles. Hemin cones littered the branching paths. The wind was scented with hemin pollen, and all the houses were built of the dark hemin wood. I stopped at last, wondering which door to knock at, when a person came sauntering out of the trees and greeted me courteously. "Will you be looking for a dwelling place?" he asked. "I've come with a question for the foretellers." I had decided to let them take me, at first anyhow, for a Karhaida. Like the investigators, I had never had any trouble passing as a native, if I wanted to. Among all the Karhidish dialects, my accent went unnoticed, and my sexual anomalies were hidden by the heavy clothing. I lacked the fine, thick hair thatch and the downward eye slant of the typical Gathenian, and was blacker and taller than most, but not beyond the range of normal variation. My beard had been permanently depilated before I left Olul. At that time we didn't yet know about the pelted tribes of Perunta, who are not only bearded but hairy all over like white Terrans. Occasionally I was asked how my nose got broken. I have a flat nose. Gathenian noses are prominent and narrow, with constricted passages well adapted to breathing sub-freezing air. The person on the path at Otherhord looked with mild curiosity at my nose and answered, "Then perhaps you'll want to speak to the weaver. He's down in the glade now, unless he went out with the wood sledge. Or would you rather first talk to one of the celibates?" "I'm not sure. I'm exceedingly ignorant." The young man laughed and bowed. "I am honored," he said. "I've lived here for 3 years, but haven't yet acquired enough ignorance to be worth mentioning." He was highly amused, but his manner was gentle, and I managed to recollect enough scraps of Handara lore to realize that I had been boasting, very much as if I'd come up to him and said, "I'm exceedingly handsome." "I meant I don't know anything about the foretellers." "Enviable," said the young indweller. "Behold, we must sully the plain snow with footprints in order to get anywhere. May I show you the way to the glade? My name is Goss." It was a first name. "Jenry," I said, abandoning my L. I followed Goss farther into the chill shade of the forest. The narrow path changed direction often, winding up the slope and down again. Here and there, near it or far away, off among the massive trunks of the hemins, stood the small forest-colored houses. Everything was red and brown, dank, still, fragrant, gloomy. From one of the houses drifted the faint whistling sweetness of a Karhidish flute. Goss went light and quick, graceful as a girl, some yards ahead of me. All at once his white shirt blazed out, and I came out after him from the shadow into full sunlight on a wide green meadow. 20 feet from us stood a figure, straight, motionless, profiled. The scarlet hieb and white shirt, an inlay of bright enamel against the green of the high grass. 100 yards beyond him stood another statue, in blue and white. This one never moved or glanced our way all the time we talked with the first one. They were practicing the Handara discipline of presence, which is a kind of trance. The Handarata, given to negatives, call it an untrance, involving self-loss, self-augmentation, through extreme sensual receptiveness and awareness. Though the technique is the exact opposite of most techniques of mysticism, it probably is a mystical discipline, tending towards the experience of immanence, but I can't categorize any practice of the Handarata with certainty. Goss spoke to the person in scarlet. As he broke from his intense movelessness and looked at us and came slowly towards us, I felt an awe of him. In that noon sunlight he shone of his own light. He was as tall as I, and slender, with a clear, open, and beautiful face. As his eyes met mine, I was suddenly moved to bespeak him, to try to reach him with the mind speech I had never used since I landed on Winter, and should not use yet. The impulse was stronger than the restraint. I bespoke him. There was no response. No contact was made. He continued to look straight at me. After a moment he smiled and said in a soft, rather high voice,
"You are the envoy, aren't you?"
I stammered and said, "Yes."
"My name is Fax. We are honored to receive you. Will you stay with us in Otherhord a while?"
"Willingly, I am seeking to learn about your practice of foretelling. And if there's anything I can tell you in return about what I am, where I come from..."
"Whatever you like," said Fax,
with a serene smile.
"This is a pleasant thing, that you should cross the oceans of space, and then add another 1,000 miles and the crossing of the Karga to your journey to come to us here."
"I wanted to come to Otherhord because of the fame of its predictions."
"You want to watch us foretelling, then, perhaps? Or have you a question of your own?"
His clear eyes compelled truth. "I don't know," I said.
"Nusuth,"
said he,
"it doesn't matter. Perhaps if you stay a while you'll find if you have a question or no question. There are only certain times, you know, when the foretellers are able to meet together, so in any case you'd dwell with us some days."
I did, and they were pleasant days. Time was unorganized except for the communal work, field labor, gardening, woodcutting, maintenance, for which transients such as myself were called on by whatever group most needed a hand. Aside from the work, a day might pass without a word spoken. Those I talked with most often were young Goss and Fax the Weaver, whose extraordinary character, as limpid and unfathomable as a well of very clear water, was a quintessence of the character of the place. In the evenings, there might be a gathering in the hearthroom of one or another of the low, tree-surrounded houses. There was conversation and beer, and there might be music, the vigorous music of Karhide, melodically simple but rhythmically complex, always played extempore. One night, two indwellers danced, men so old that their hair had whitened, and their limbs were skinny, and the downward folds at the outer eye corners half hid their dark eyes. Their dancing was slow, precise, controlled. It fascinated eye and mind. They began dancing during third hour after dinner. Musicians joined in and dropped out at will, all but the drummer, who never stopped his subtle changing beat. The two old dancers were still dancing at sixth hour, midnight, after 5 Terran hours. This was the first time I had seen the phenomenon of Dothe, the voluntary, controlled use of what we call hysterical strength. And thereafter I was readier to believe tales concerning the old men of the Handara. It was an introverted life, self-sufficient, stagnant, steeped in that singular ignorance prized by the Handarata, and obedient to their rule of inactivity or non-interference. That rule, expressed in the word Nusuth, which I have to translate as no matter, is the heart of the cult, and I don't pretend to understand it. But I began to understand Karhide better after a half month in Otherhord. Under that nation's politics and parades and passions run an old darkness, passive, anarchic, silent, the fecund darkness of the Handara. And out of that silence, inexplicably, rises the foreteller's voice. Young Goss, who enjoyed acting as my guide, told me that my question to the foretellers would concern anything and be phrased as I liked. "The more qualified and limited the question, the more exact the answer," he said. "Vagueness breeds vagueness, and some questions, of course, are not answerable." "What if I ask one of those?" I inquired. This hedging seemed sophisticated, but not unfamiliar. But I did not expect his answer.
"The weaver will refuse it. Unanswerable questions have wrecked foretelling groups."
"Wrecked them?"
"Do you know the story of the Lord of Shorth, who forced the foretellers of Asen Fastness to answer the question, 'What is the meaning of life?' Well, it was a couple of 1,000 years ago. The foretellers stayed in the darkness for 6 days and nights. At the end, all the celibates were catatonic. The zanies were dead. The pervert clubbed the Lord of Shorth to death with a stone, and the weaver, he was a man named Meshe.
The founder of the Yomesh cult?
Yes, said Gosh, and laughed as if the story was very funny. But I didn't know whether the joke was on the Yomeshter or on me. I had decided to ask a yes or no question, which might at least make plain the extent and kind of obscurity and ambiguity in the answer. Facts had confirmed what Goss had said, that the matter of the question could be one of which the foretellers were perfectly ignorant. I could ask if the Hulm crops would be good this year in the northern hemisphere of S, and they would answer, having no previous knowledge even of the existence of a planet called S. This seemed to put the business on the plane of pure chance divination, along with yarrow stalks and flipped coins. No, said Fax, not at all. Chance was not involved. The whole process was in fact precisely the reverse of chance.
Then you mind-read?
No, said Fax, with his serene and candid smile. You mind-read without knowing you're doing it, perhaps?
What good would that be? If the asker knew the answer, he wouldn't pay our price for it.
I chose a question to which I certainly lacked the answer. Only time could prove the foretelling right or wrong, unless it was, as I expected, one of those admirable professional prophecies applicable to any outcome. It was not a trivial question. I had given up the notion of asking when it would stop raining, or some such trifle, when I learned that the undertaking was a hard and dangerous one for the 9 foretellers of Otherhord. The cost was high for the speaker. 2 of my rubies went to the coffers of the fastness, but higher for the answerers. And as I got to know Fax, if it became difficult to believe that he was a professional faker, it became still more difficult to believe that he was an honest, self-deluded faker. His intelligence was as hard, clear, and polished as my rubies. I dared set no trap for him. I asked what I most wanted to know. On Netherhad, the 18th of the month, the 9 met together in a big building, usually kept locked. One high hall, stone-floored and cold, dimly lighted by a couple of slit windows and a fire in the deep hearth at one end. They sat on the bare stone in a circle, all of them cloaked and hooded, rough, still shapes like a circle of dolmens in the faint glow of the fire yards away. Goss and a couple of other young indwellers, and a physician from the nearest domain, watched in silence from seats by the hearth while I crossed the hall and entered the circle. It was all very informal and very tense. One of the hooded figures looked up as I came amongst them, and I saw a strange face, coarse-featured, heavy, with insolent eyes, watching me. Fax sat cross-legged, not moving, but charged, full of a gathering force that made his light, soft voice crack like an electric bolt.
"Ask,"
he said. I stood within the circle and asked my question. "Will this world, Gethen, be a member of the Ecumen of Known Worlds 5 years from now?" Silence. I stood there. I hung in the center of a spiderweb woven of silence.
"It is answerable,"
the weaver said quietly. There was a relaxation. The hooded stone seemed to soften into movement. The one who had looked so strangely at me began to whisper to his neighbor. I left the circle and joined the watchers by the hearth. 2 of the foretellers remained withdrawn, unspeaking. One of them lifted his left hand from time to time and patted the floor lightly and swiftly 10 or 20 times, then sat motionless again. I had seen neither of them before. They were the Zanies, Goss said. They were insane. Goss called them time dividers, which may mean schizophrenics. Karhidish psychologists, though lacking mind speech and thus like blind surgeons, were ingenious with drugs, hypnosis, spot shock, cryonic touch, and various mental therapies. I asked if these 2 psychopaths could not be cured.
Cured? Goss said. Would you cure a singer of his voice?
5 others of the circle were indwellers of Otherhord, adepts in the Handala disciplines of presence, and also, said Goss, so long as they remained foretellers, celibate, taking no mate during their periods of sexual potency. One of these celibates must be in Kemah during the foretelling. I could pick him out, having learned to notice the subtle physical intensification, a kind of brightness that signalizes the first phase of Kemah. Beside the Kemera sat the pervert.
He came up from Sprev, with the physician, Goss told me.
Some foretelling groups artificially arouse perversion in a normal person, injecting female or male hormones during the days before a session. It is better to have a natural one. He is willing to come, likes the notoriety. Goss used the pronoun that designates a male animal, not the pronoun for a human being in the masculine role of Kemer. He looked a little embarrassed. Carhiders discuss sexual matters freely, and talk about Kemer with both reverence and gusto, but they are reticent about discussing perversion. At least they were with me. Excessive prolongation of the Kemer period, with permanent hormonal imbalance towards the male or the female, causes what they call perversion. It is not rare. 3 or 4% of adults may be physiological perverts or abnormals, normals by our standard. They are not excluded from society, but they are tolerated with some disdain, as homosexuals are in many bisexual societies. The Karhidish slang for them is half-deads. They are sterile. The pervert of the group, after that first long strange stare at me, paid no heed to anyone but the one next to him, the Kemerer, whose increasingly active sexuality would be further roused and finally stimulated into full female sexual capacity by the insistent, exaggerated maleness of the pervert. The pervert kept talking softly, leaning towards the Kemerer, who answered little and seemed to recoil. None of the others had spoken for a long time now. There was no sound but the whisper of the pervert's voice. Fax was steadily watching one of the zanies. The pervert lay his hand quickly and softly on the Kemerer's hand. The Kemerer avoided the touch hastily, with fear or disgust, and looked across at Fax as if for help. Fax did not move. The Kemerer kept his place, and kept still when the pervert touched him again. One of the zanies lifted up his face and laughed a long, false, crooning laugh.
Ah! Ah!
Fax raised his hand. At once, each face in the circle turned to him, as if he had gathered up their gazes into a sheaf, a skein. It had been afternoon and raining when we entered the hall. The grey light had soon died out of the slit windows under the eaves. Now, whitish strips of light stretched like slanting phantasmal sails, long triangles and oblongs from wall to floor over the faces of the nine, dull scraps and shreds of light from the moon rising over the forest outside. The fire had burned down long since, and there was no light but those strips and slants of dimness creeping across the circle, sketching out a face, a hand, a moveless back. For a while I saw Fax's profile ridges as pale stone in the diffused dust of light. The diagonal of moonlight crept on and came to a black hump, the Kemerer. Head bowed on his knees, hands clenched on the floor, body shaken by a regular tremor repeated by the slutter pat-pat of the zany's hand on stone in darkness across the circle. They were all connected, all of them, as if they were in the suspension points of a spider-web. I felt, whether I wished or not, the connection, the communication that ran, wordless, inarticulate, through Fax, and which Fax was trying to pattern and control, for he was the center, the weaver. The dim light fragmented and died away, creeping up the eastern wall. The web of force, of tension, of silence, grew. I tried to keep out of contact with the minds of the foretellers. I was made very uneasy by that silent electric tension, by the sense of being drawn in, of becoming a point or figure in the pattern, in the web. But when I set up a barrier, it was worse. I felt cut off and cowered inside my own mind, obsessed by hallucinations of sight and touch, a stew of wild images and notions, abrupt visions and sensations, all sexually charged and grotesquely violent, a red and black seething of erotic rage. I was surrounded by great gaping pits and ragged lips, vaginas, wounds, hell mouths. I lost my balance. I was falling. If I could not shut out this chaos, I would fall indeed. I would go mad, and there was no shutting it out. The emphatic and paraverbal forces at work, immensely powerful and confused, rising out of the perversion and frustration of sex, out of an insanity that distorts time and out of an appalling discipline of total concentration and apprehension of immediate reality, were far beyond my restraint or control. And yet they were controlled. The center was still Fax. Hours and seconds passed. The moonlight shone on the wrong wall. There was no moonlight, only darkness, and in the center of all darkness, Fax, the weaver, a woman dressed in light. The light was silver. Silver was armor. an armored woman with a sword. The light burned sudden and intolerable, the light along her limbs, the fire, and she screamed aloud in terror and pain, "Yes! Yes! Yes!" The crooning laugh of the zany began, "Ah! Ah! Ah! Ah!" and rose higher and higher into a wavering yell that went on and on, much longer than any voice could go on yelling, right across time. There was movement in the darkness, scuffling and shuffling, a redistribution of ancient sentries, an evasion of four shadows. "Light! Light!" said an immense voice in vast syllables once or innumerable times. "Light! Log on the fire there! Some light!" It was the physician from Sprev. He had entered the circle. It was all broken. He was kneeling by the zanies, the frailest ones, the fuse points. Both of them lay huddled up on the floor. The camera lay with his head on Fax's knees, breathing in gasps, still trembling. Fax's hand, with absent gentleness, stroked his hair. The pervert was off by himself in a corner, sullen and dejected. The session was over. Time passed as usual. The web of power had fallen apart into indignity and weariness. Where was my answer? The riddle of the oracle, the ambiguous utterance of prophecy. I knelt down beside Fax. He looked at me with his clear eyes. For that instant I saw him as I had seen him in the dark, as a woman armed in light and burning in a fire, crying out, "Yes!" Fax's soft speaking voice broke the vision.
"Are you answered, Asker?"
"I am answered, Weaver." Indeed, I was answered. 5 years from now, Gethen would be a member of the Ecumen. Yes. No riddles, no hedging. Even then I was aware of the quality of that answer, not so much a prophecy as an observation. I could not evade my own certainty that the answer was right. It had the imperative clarity of a hunch. We have Nafal ships and instantaneous transmission and mind speech, but we haven't yet tamed hunch to run in harness. For that trick, we must go to Gethen.
"I serve as the filament,"
Fax said to me a day or two after the foretelling.
"The energy builds up and builds up in us, always sent back and back, redoubling the impulse every time until it breaks through and the light is in me, around me. I am the light." The old man of Arbin Fastness once said that if the weaver could be put in a vacuum at the moment of the answer, he'd go on burning for years. That's what the Yomeshta believe of Mesh. That he saw past and future clear, not for a moment, but all during his life after the question of Shorth. It's hard to believe. I doubt a man could endure it. But no matter.
Nusuth, the ubiquitous and ambiguous negative of the Handara. We were strolling side by side, and Fax looked at me. His face, one of the most beautiful human faces I ever saw, seemed hard and delicate as carved stone.
"In the darkness," he said, "there were 10, not 9. There was a stranger."
"Yes, there was. I had no barrier against you. You are a listener, Fax, a natural empath, and probably a powerful natural telepath as well. That's why you're the weaver, the one who can keep the tensions and responses of the group running in a self-augmenting pattern until the strain breaks the pattern itself, and you reach through for your answer." He listened with grave interest.
"It is strange to see the mysteries of my discipline from outside through your eyes. I've only seen them from within. As a disciple."
"If you permit, if you wish, Fax, I should like to communicate with you in mind speech." I was sure now that he was a natural communicant. His consent and a little practice should serve to lower his unwitting barrier.
"Once you did that, I would hear what others think?"
"Oh, no, no, no more than you do already as an empath. Mind speech is communication, voluntarily sent and received."
"Then why not speak aloud?"
"Well, one can lie speaking."
"Not mind speaking?"
"Not intentionally." Pax considered a while. That's a discipline that must arouse the interest of kings, politicians, men of business.
Men of business fought against the use of mind speech when it first was found to be a teachable skill. They outlawed it for decades.
Fax smiled. And kings?
We have no more kings.
Yes, I see that. Well, I thank you, Genry. But my business is unlearning, not learning, and I'd rather not yet learn an art that would change the world entirely.
By your own foretelling, this world will change, and within 5 years.
And I'll change with it, Genry. But I have no wish to change it.
It was raining, the long, fine rain of Gathenian summer. We walked under the hemon trees on the slopes above the fastness, where there were no paths. Light fell grey among dark branches, clear water dropped from the scarlet needles. The air was chill yet mild, and full of the sound of rain.
Fax, tell me this. You, Handarata, have a gift that men on every world have craved. You have it. You can predict the future, and yet you live like the rest of us. It doesn't seem to matter.
How should it matter, Genry?
Well, look. For instance, this rivalry between Karhide and Orgoraine, this quarrel about the Sinoth Valley. Karhide has lost face badly these last weeks, I gather. Now, why didn't King Argaven consult his foretellers, asking which course to take, or which member of the Kaioremi to choose as Prime Minister, or something of that sort?
The questions are hard to ask.
I don't see why. He might simply ask, who'll serve me best as Prime Minister, and leave it at that.
He might, but he doesn't know what serving him best may mean. It might mean the man chosen would surrender the valley to Orgoraine, or go into exile, or assassinate the king. It might mean many things he wouldn't expect or accept.
He'd have to make his question very precise.
Yes, then there'd be many questions, you see. Even the king must pay the price.
You'd charge him high.
Very high, said Fax tranquilly. The asker pays what he can afford, as you know. Kings have, in fact, come to the foretellers, but not very often.
What if one of the foretellers is himself a powerful man?
Indwellers of the fastness have no rank or status. I may be sent to Erhenrang, to the Kaioremi. Well, if I go, I take back my status and my shadow, but my foretelling's at an end. If I had a question while I served in the Kaioremi, I'd go to Orgni Farsnes there, pay my price, and get my answer. But we in the Handara don't want answers. It's hard to avoid them, but we try to.
Fax, I don't think I understand.
Well, we come here to the Farsnes mostly to learn what questions not to ask.
But you're the answerers.
You don't see yet, Genry, why we perfect it and practice foretelling.
No.
To exhibit the perfect uselessness of knowing the answer to the wrong question.
I pondered that a good while as we walked side by side through the rain, under the dark branches of the forest of Otherhord. Within the white hood, Fax's face was tired and quiet, its light quenched. Yet he still awed me a little. When he looked at me with his clear, kind, candid eyes, he looked at me out of a tradition 13,000 years old. A way of thought and a way of life so old, so well established, so integral and coherent as to give a human being the unself-consciousness, the authority, the completeness of a wild animal, a great strange creature who looks straight at you out of his eternal present.
"The unknown," said Fax's soft voice in the forest. "The unforetold, the unproven, that is what life is based on. Ignorance is the ground of thought. Unproof is the ground of action. If it were proven that there is no God, there would be no religion, no Handara, no Yomesh, no hearth gods, nothing. But also if it were proven that there is a God, there would be no religion. Tell me, Genry, what is known? What is sure, predictable, inevitable? The one certain thing you know concerning your future and mine.
That we shall die?
Yes. There's really only one question that can be answered, Genri, and we already know the answer. The only thing that makes life possible is permanent, intolerable uncertainty, not knowing what comes next.